What's that?
Welcome back to Afoot, a mystery genre podcast in which we ask the question, is the foot gamey? Well, it depends how long ago the murder occurred to answer that. But in this episode, we're going to talk about two gamey murder mysteries of sorts. We're going to talk about two movies from the 1970s, Murder by Death from 1976 and The Cheap Detective from 1978, both written by Neil Simon, movies that people have fond memories of, which we'll try to ruin. Joining me in this endeavor, by the way, I'm Glenn Fleischman, your host, who must be discombobulated by all the parodies around him. But joining me are David Lohr, who is 107 years old, but did remember seeing these films at some point when they were first out. Hello, David.
Bonjour.
Joining me also is Erica Ensign from the Great North. Hello, Erica.
Hello. You can call me the Blue Chipmunk.
Oh, I like that.
Ooh, hey.
Well, the chipmunk's blue because it's so cold, right? It's frozen solid?
Yeah, pretty much.
Poor chipmunk. Also with us is John McCoy. John, hello.
Any film with Truman Capote is all right with me.
It's how many films is that, my question?
But. There's just the one, but...
I was going to say, it's one of the most surprising things. And also joining us is Susie Steffen. Hello, Susie.
Hey.
Good to have you with us. Because we don't reveal anyone's age on this show, well, except our own, I can admit that I saw Murder by Death in the theaters as a small child. In fact, I'm pretty sure my memory is that I asked my mother to take me and a bunch of friends there for my birthday. But it might have been a different movie. It did come out the year that I would have been 8, so my memory may be a little off because I think it was my 7th birthday. It also came out in June, and my birthday's in March. So who knows whether I have a fiction in my head or and I'm a robot.
It's headcanon. It's okay.
My headcanon is good much.
I mean, I remember the ads incessantly and wanting to see it. And when it finally came to TV and I got to see it, like, you know what, a year and a half, 2 years later, and really enjoying it. And it's a very lovely opening credits. And, you know, I fell into it as a, 7-year-old, 8-year-old.
This reminds me, too, before we get underway, both movies, there's obviously spoilers because they're mysteries of sorts, even though they're parody films. So we're going to talk generally about both movies and kind of the cast and the kind of overview of the thing. But before we get into anything that might spoil the film, we will fire off the spoiler horn. And if you have a podcast player that has chapter marks, look to skip those if you don't want it to be spoiled and you want to see the film and know what the surprises are. If you do not have a podcast app that does such a thing, look in the show notes and I will put a timestamp for how you can skip the spoiler for Murder by Death and jump to Cheap Detective's non-spoilery part 2. So that's the mechanics of this episode. But let's talk about, you know, David is a playwright, so he has maybe some special insight into Neil Simon. The rest of us may not. Susie, I forgot. Susie, are you a playwright or a dramaturge? You are involved in this realm.
A theater critic.
Theater critic. So you have some thoughts. I appeared once in Last of the Red Hot Lovers in high school. So that's my insight to Neil Simon.
In high school?
I don't know. I don't know why we did that play. It's not a good play. It's not a good play. Anyway.
I have a not good Neil Simon play story, but...
Neil Simon, one of the best known American playwrights, comedian playwrights of the modern era, and also wrote a lot of plays that were turned into movies and movies. And this is a pair of films that he wrote. I don't know all the genesis of it, but they were, you know, spoofs, which were popular in the time. It was a kind of common thing. And I wanted to revisit them because I have such fond memories about them. They're kind of in the canon. People talk about Murder by Death maybe a little more than Cheap Detective, but they kind of sit out there as this mark in the past. They're now, of course, 40 years in the past. Oh, my God. I'm old now. And revisiting them is interesting because I don't think I'd seen either film for many decades. I think I'd seen Murder by Death again at some point, and I can't quite remember. So I wanted to see how memory contrasted. Does anyone else have early memories of Murder by Death back from, you know, either when it was originally out or some time ago?
I saw both of these in the theater. Actually, my grandma McCoy took me back in 76 to see this. And I was as confused as all get out. However, I had seen the Sidney Lumet Murder on the Orient Express, so I understood the Poirot character. That was about it.
Yeah, I had my mother gave me a very quick primer on the characters that I didn't know, but there weren't that many. I got the Nick and Nora, I got Fu Manchu, Charlie Chan, I got the Obviously, I got Poirot and Miss Marple. So yeah, it was. I was okay.
I did not see these movies when they came out, although I was alive when the second one came out. So I don't think I would have appreciated its subtleties at the age of one. So I'm pretty sure my mom didn't take me.
No, you might have been fine.
That's right.
Maybe.
Wait, that's a spoiler. That's a spoiler.
Deep cut.
But I had heard of Murder by Death. I didn't really know anything about it, but that title meant something to me. I knew it was a movie sort of from that era. I had never heard of The Cheap Detective until a couple months ago. My boss and I were talking about movies, and I love my boss. She's somebody, we have similar taste and stuff, and she said that The Cheap Detective is like one of her comfort food movies because she just loves Peter Falk in it so much. And I was like, oh, interesting. I should check that out. And then I think I was the one that suggested this podcast episode because I had not heard of these movies, and they were both, you know, parody spoofy things of mysteries, and we talk about mysteries. So here we are, and maybe at the end of the podcast, I will either say you're welcome or apologize.
Well, I was going to say, Erica, why did you call us all here together tonight into the accusing room? I'm not sure what's going on.
Yep, exactly.
This is the denouement lounge. We've got plenty of time.
That's right. They're not in the accusing lounge yet. I should maybe mention the... I'm sorry. Susie, do you have a memory of this film before I...
Nothing at all. I mean, I was alive, but that's all you're, not watching movies,
you remember
I think.
Being alive.
One other thing, Glenn, I would say is that Murder by Death was constantly run as a TV movie in the late 70s.
Yeah.
Back in the days before HBO, before cable, you know, the big networks would re-show movies over and over again. And I just remember Murder by Death being on like every year from about 76 to about 81 or so.
Yep, it was on the ABC Sunday Night Movie regularly. And I remember the first time I got to see it, because that's where I saw it, and realizing that all of the caricatures in the opening credits were done by Charles Adams, and just going, oh, I know that.
Oh, yeah. I think that may be why, John, I think that may be why I remember seeing it after, because I'm pretty sure I've seen it more than that one time I saw it in the theater, but I remember being young, and I bet it was in fact on the reruns back in the early days of VHS. So let me recap the plot very, very briefly. We've gotten to parts of it. So it's a parody. And maybe somebody has insight into this. I didn't do the deep research into why it came out exactly then. There may not be a reason, but you know, you're coming off the heels of film from practically when film was invented. They started doing murder mysteries, and murder mysteries were adapted in massive numbers, whether it's Holmes or Christie or original things. So it's not like there was a point in time where there was a glut on the mystery market, although the Murder on the Orient Express obviously was a big a mark in the sand and a fantastic movie, and was super MacGuffin-y of all, you know, that it was the most giant MacGuffin. So maybe it inspired this moment, kind of like some of the later Mel Brooks ones actually were relevant to the movies that had just come out instead of coming out, you know, 2 years or 20 years before. So Murder on the Murder on the Orient Express was 2 years before this, 1974.
Well, and mentioning Mel Brooks is right on, because this came right on the heels of Mel having huge success with Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles and Silent Movie, and he was working on High Anxiety. So he was in this mode. And, of course, he and Simon had worked together in the 50s on Your Show of Shows.
Yeah.
And so this was sort of like, hey, I can do something in Mel's style. And so that's why it's a lot sillier than most of Simon's other movies, certainly from that period.
Well, it's trying for a kind of farce that's much more, like an absurdist farce that's much more Brooksian than, I mean, not that Simon is always brilliant and Oscar-Wildean, but this is a little lower brow.
Yeah, this is totally comedy sketch, spoof characters with silly names, and the hook, maybe a little bit of Murder on the Orient Express, but also And Then There Were None.
Oh yeah, yeah, everyone back.
So it's very right, much an Agatha definitely. Christie yeah. it has, template.
It has all the tropes too, and you know, so the
yeah.
well,
yeah.
so going back to like so the brief, the very brief synopsis is, it's all the world's greatest movie, or it's all the world's greatest detectives parodies of them, but the movie versions rather than the book versions. It's, so you have Nick and Nora mm-hmm. parody. You've got two different Agatha Christies. You've got I say Jessica Fletcher.
Philip Marlowe. Or no, you got a Dashiell Hammett style.
Dashiell Hammett, right.
Yes.
And you've got the super racist, like double racist number where you have both the original, you just said it and I've lost the name, not Fu Manchu, but
Charlie Chan.
Which is already terrible. And then you have Peter Sellers' depiction of it, which is both a parody and also equally, well, we'll talk about that, equally problematic in its own way, which is great. And then Truman Capote, of course, in there. And the cast is unbelievable. I mean, I remember when the cast list is running, so you have those fantastic Charles Adams credits, which I'd completely forgotten,
yeah.
and they're magnificent. You know, it's...
Best thing in the movie, honestly.
Yeah.
no, even aside from it, whatever else is in the movie,
yeah.
it's still the best thing.
They're so well, it's so perfectly done. But yeah, I mean, just, yeah. I won't read off the, people can look up the credits, but you know, people like Elsa Lanchester just incidentally being in the movie, and having Peter Sellers and Alec Guinness and David Niven in one film is unbelievable.
Oh yeah, we were freaking out as the credits were rolling, going, like, "What?
Really?
What?
And
what?
And
this
Maggie
is going
to
be the greatest movie ever."
and James but, Cromwell.
James Cromwell, but, this, but he's very, very young.
This reminds
movie.
Me of all the other films that came out after, basically after Around the World in 80 Days
oh,
kind of made yeah. that whole movement of crazy huge casts, you know, ensemble casts, and also sort of the beginnings of stunt casting, because Truman Capote, you know, is just in there because he's Truman Capote, and that's just mm-hmm. weird. But it reminded me of a lot of 70s variety shows where you tried to get as many stars in as you could, and it didn't necessarily always gel. And in this movie, I think mostly the people played well together, but there was a lot of, I also think, attempts to upstage one another.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Now, it all gels pretty well. And, you know, considering you're taking all these different styles, too. I mean, Nick and Nora are very different from Sam Spade. It's very different from Poirot. They somehow work. I'll give it that.
Well, and the actors were not... I think, you know, it's a tribute to the performers they cast in this. The material, which we'll get to after the spoiler horn, maybe, is the actors really do... sell their performances. I don't feel like anyone is, you know, you've seen a lot of movies in which someone is cast or paid a lot of money. They don't really want to be there and they phone it in. In this case, everyone is chewing the hell out of the scenery or doing
yeah.
David Niven is being his David Niven-iest best. And Maggie Smith as well. They're magnificent.
Right.
They're, mm-hmm. You can feel the backstory to the relationship and whatever. It's if the material is thin, they're not letting it show. So let me just introduce the plot, and then we're going to fire off the spoiler horn. I think people may have gotten the gist of our feeling about this movie, but the basic plot is right. All these different detectives who have been invited to a mansion by someone named Lionel Twain, which is that joke, and used in different ways, who was played by Truman Capote. And Truman Capote is, I think, quite wonderful in his little bitchy style in this mm-hmm. movie. It's just perfect for him. They're invited to the mansion, and he sets essentially a contest in front of them that he thinks he is the world's greatest detective, and that he will, someone's going to be murdered at midnight, and a reward of $1 million will be presented to whoever discovers it, and it goes from there. So I think that's fair enough. Are we done with our pre-spoiler discussion, and we'll fire it off?
I think that sounds fair.
Okay. So I gather people having rewatched this film may not have strongly positive things to say about it or watched it for the first time.
Rewatch or watch for the first time.
Right.
Yes. Killed Good Weekend.
Can I say, I feel like my reaction to this and also Cheap Detective is they seem like movies that are set up to be much funnier than they are. Like they're waiting for laughs to happen that never occur.
I don't want to say too much about the Cheap Detective, so I will just say
that
I was amused by the idea of Murder by Death. I was very excited to watch it, and as they were introducing the characters, I was still kind of on board. It was I'm not a big fan of over the top slapsticky type thing, so I was just sort of trying to set that part of my mind aside because it was clear that's the kind of movie this is, and I didn't want to bash the movie simply because it's not made for me. So I was kind of enjoying it at first. I mean, you see the first shot of the Nick and Nora characters, and he's holding a martini glass, even though they're standing on the side of the road in front of like a payphone. And I love Nick and Nora. The Thin Man movies are fantastic. So I was like, okay, they get these characters. They, you know, he did his homework to understand who they are and to play up the. It's a caricature. That's fun. So I was going along with it. And then we got to Peter Sellers, and I was immediately like dragged out of the film going, oh, my God.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was not ready for that. So every time he was on the screen, I just was super, super cringy. But I also tried to just kind of ignore that piece of it to see if there's anything else in the movie that I could really sink my teeth into and enjoy. And the longer it went on, and the stupider it got, and the less able to understand. Like, I get the idea that some mystery stories are very convoluted, and you have to follow an awful lot of rabbit holes and such to get to where it's going. And I think in trying to parody that part of mysteries, it went up its own butt too far. That I didn't want to follow it anymore.
Nice.
Yeah, and I think you hit the point there too, that because you get the most problematic depiction of Peter Sellers playing Sidney Wang. So not only, so you have, like, I want to unpack this for a second. So you have the pretty racist, yeah. Charlie Chan is already a pretty racist character the way it's written. It's one of those like clever oriental characters, to use the blunt terminology of the time, where you're supposed to actually feel like you're not being racist when these were written, because he's presented as clever, right? Inscrutable and clever, not somebody to mock, although his appearance, I mean, I've read some of the stories from that time, and it's a mixed bag. So first level is, it's a parody of that. Then you have the film depiction, which the character is almost always played by white people in, like, you know, yellow face drag, right? So the movie versions of Charlie Chan are a problem. Then you have Peter Sellers doing a parody with a character named Sidney Wang, so you're doing a bad name joke, and his portrayal is not very far off from the movie, like, yellow face mock-ups or mocking of, you know, Chinese people. So it's not even like, you don't even get that, right? So he has like multiple levels of problematic, and it comes so early, and the number one son business, the son being Japanese, is the whole thing, and just the whole thing isn't very funny.
And of course, being named Willy Wang, because we gotta really nail that joke.
Oh my God, the number of poop and penis jokes in this film were really extraordinary.
Yeah, well, and I may have to do an unjustly maligned about Charlie Chan someday, but that's for another podcast.
Problematic doesn't mean bad. It's just
I know.
You have to unpick.
And the books aren't so bad. Some of the movies aren't so bad. Then they get worse and worse. But especially this, I mean, the only clever thing about it is having Peter Sellers do it, simply because it's in a smarter movie. It's commenting on the fact that it's always a white guy playing Charlie Chan.
Right.
And so it's like, all right, if this movie were less concerned with dick jokes and poop jokes, it might have made a comment on that.
That's, yeah, if this were a better movie, but that's very sad but true, I think. It's like, it's not as clever as it wants to be. It thinks it's being, or it's acting as if it's cleverer than it is about a genre that is stooping to be in, but it's not cleverer than that.
And it's, you know, in a way, you have Sellers coasting on his Goon Show experience, because they did, I mean, it was three white guys. They did all the voices for all the nationalities, and it was fine in the 50s on the radio. And some of those episodes are problematic. But this is sort of like, yeah, all right, no. And then you have the, he did his own Fu Manchu movie a couple of years later abominable. Oh, no. Oh, my God. I can't even remember the full title of it.
That's nearly as bad as the Tony Randall one. Remember that one? I saw that as a kid, too.
The Seven Faces of Dr. Lao.
Yeah, that is pro.
That's based on a decent book, though.
Yeah. But
by Charles Beaumont. That's another podcast, too. Yes. But the movie, oh dear.
Any other thought? I don't want to step on everybody. Anybody else?
I think you made a really good point when you said that these were based upon the movie versions of these characters. Because one of the things that's interesting about this to me is I was realizing that Simon doesn't really show any particular interest, knowledge, or affinity of the mystery tradition in any way. It's just kind of like he pulls down the broadest strokes of what he's seen these characters, you know, as he's seen them portrayed in movies, and there's not really any clever, you know, deconstruction of actual mystery tropes or mystery plot lines or anything. The mystery plot lines, such as they are, consist with improbable rooms being replaced with rooms and just kind of zany pratfalls. And I, you know, one has never actually read a mystery novel in which those things take place. I think it's also
that was weird.
I think it's also informative that basically we have two different Dashiell Hammett sets of characters and two different Agatha Christie sets of characters, and then you have Charlie Cham. It doesn't go to Sherlock Holmes. It doesn't go to Dorothy Sayers, which would be the obvious thing. I think the other thing, the Rabbi Smalls mysteries were popular at this time. You think that they would have done that, or Travis McGee. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there he could have worked with, but he went with stuff that had very recognizable movie prototypes. And largely recognizable movie prototypes from a decade or two before.
Well, I want to bring this up, or even the 1940s, maybe. And I was, so I'm wondering, I felt somewhere along the line where I'm like, is this movie made for people who in 1976 were 50 years old, but the humor is made for people?
Yes.
But the humor is made for people who are 7 years old, having been
Well, but now. I got all those references from seeing all those movies over and over on Channel 44 in Tampa Bay. And because, you had Charlie Chan every week, and you had The Thin Man running, and you had all of these different things. So the references would have been gotten, I think. Going back to the plot of, you know, rooms changing rooms and all that stuff. I can think of exactly one novel, one mystery that has a room that changes rooms. But all of the things in this feel like something out of a 30s or 40s mystery movie. They're these preposterous things that, you know, even in books that are adapted into movies, they would throw this kind of stuff in there because, like, hey, let's do this. This would be freaky. And, you know, some of those are just preposterous.
But don't you think it's a little bit like theater, though, David? You know, it's got these kind of a room farce where people are.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
I was also thinking about how the movies, I think, so like the difference between, this will sound silly, but the difference between something like Airplane and Ace Ventura Pet Detective, stop me if you've heard this one before. So Airplane, I think,
it's,
is so...
It's the poop jokes, right? Yeah,
well, Airplane, I think, is like completely, the first movie is completely an archetype of playing something absolutely straight no matter what's going on. There is no breaking of the character within the show that something weird is happening. It's just they're in a problematic universe that's hilarious to us, but is absolutely consequences for them, right? And I think the seriousness of movies like that are like total farces that are acted without any mugging. And then Ace Ventura is the other extreme. I tried to watch that once, and it is 100% people reacting to Jim Carrey doing ridiculous things, and in character in the film, they're like, ha, or ooh, or what? You know, and you're like, all right, that's the reaction film where the audience is so stupid you need a proxy in the movie. I felt like Murder by Death couldn't figure out whether it was playing it straight, which a lot of the actors were, but they put them in scenes where the actors are like, what's going on? Oh, what's that about? Oh, the doorbell's making the sound. It's like they were deconstructing the film from the inside in it, or reacting to like Alec Guinness's character, James Serbenson Mum, which is vaguely funny.
And for instance, how often does Miss Marple have anyone actually connected to her? How often does Poirot have a chauffeur?
Oh, right.
Everybody has someone to react. Everyone has a partner to deal with.
Right. Nick and Nora.
And a subordinate.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though this is a parody, I didn't like that, someone was putting Maggie Smith in the corner, that it was Nick and Nora, but Nick was the only one that's important, and Nora, the comment in the film, no wives, I said no wives, it's like, that's deeply misogynistic, and it's not funny. I guess it was supposed to be funny.
Mm-hmm. I don't even think that's a good sort of comment on Nick and Nora, because that was not a piece of what their movies were about. It was so weird.
I mean, if you're using Nick and Nora, you get the pair. There's no negotiation there.
And the other people in most of the Thin Man films recognized that. So that wasn't like a running theme in those movies that people would be expecting to talk to him and end up with her. Like, I think most of the people surrounding them recognized that she was the one keeping him going. I mean, that was the joke.
Often he didn't even want to get involved, and she's the one going, "Oh, Nikki, can we solve this mystery? Come on."
This reminds me I should watch some Nick and Nora movies, clearly.
Yeah, really.
Wow, we all
absolutely.
And read that. Some Craig Rice novels.
But so, I don't know, I just found this movie, it seemed very disappointing to me because I kept waiting for jokes to happen, and then, I can see.
There's your title, Waiting for Jokes.
Waiting for jokes. And I can see, I've seen Neil Simon plays, I've been in some, I've read a lot of Neil Simon, especially his earlier work. And I mean, this is from his prime period or close to it. And I thought, okay, I can see setting this up. I can see all the Neil Simon wheels in action. And then there is no payoff. Mm-hmm. The payoff is this damp fart, right? It's not a mm-hmm. not a laugh.
Well, there are a few things I would say I still admired about this film. Peter Falk is great throughout it, just basically being Peter Falk. and Alec Guinness, I think, was the one guy who really committed to playing this absurd role with a completely straight face.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reveal at the end of the story where it seems at first that Alec Guinness is the murderer and he gets to play the murderer until the murderer actually reveals who he is. That's quite a set of little acting scenes he goes through there, and I have to kind of admire that.
I did like the Willy Wonka quality of that scene. I actually did laugh during that scene, and especially there is something funny before Scooby-Doo had turned that into that kind of trope that we were all familiar with. The mask after mask after mask after mask. I was like, oh yeah, and then there kept being more. That was kind of funny.
Well, it's a nice twist on the whole "the butler did it"
thing.
That's the one clever mystery gag in the whole thing.
Well, and then you get a Willy Wonka like moment before Willy Wonka of Truman Capote saying, "You get nothing." Like, you're all wrong.
That was after Willy Wonka.
Was it at 76?
Yeah.
When was Willy Wonka?
71.
Well, I'm sorry. Then you get a Willy Wonka moment after Willy Wonka. But I did like it nonetheless.
Also, Natalie Walker in a very small role just does everything she can with that tiny little role, I think.
I've always loved her. I loved her in all the various TV things. But yeah, especially being a deaf mute, ostensibly.
That's tough. That's tough to pull off.
The screaming part where she comes in screaming.
Yes.
Silently.
Yeah.
It was clever. So one of the things is this is an escape room mystery, right? It's sort of a locked room or escape room. They were in escape rooms trying to get out. And I think it was clever about the notion of having multiple rooms that were identical and seemed like once the plot starts to uncover, I'm like, wow, that is like, I could see in a different film, a serious movie, this is would be a very clever device and also very difficult to pull off. And, you know, it sort of becomes like one of those Saw style movies. You're like, why would someone build a house like this? So it gets a little crazy. But there's, you know, it's a farce. There's no consequences. There's not always commitment to the farce concept. The actors are all great. And the cleverest part of the movie or cleverest parts don't actually relate to it necessarily being that funny.
They were supposed to have Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Sherlock Holmes was supposed to come in at the end, right? And solve it. But the actors didn't want that.
That's funny that they rebelled. This also reminds me of another thing, which is, and this is something that astonished me, as I said to David Lur on Slack, I said, oh, well, David, doesn't this remind you also of that made-for-TV movie that which Johnny Carson is revealed to be the murderer of all these comedians at the end? And he said, I never saw that. And I went, what? I know. It's called Joys, J-O-Y-S. It was made in, let's see if I can find the year. I'm looking at this.
77?
It was supposedly a parody somewhere of Jaws and called Joys. And the joke was, 1976 Bob Hope TV special. Mm-hmm. And the idea was every major comedian with TV shows is getting killed off scene after scene. At the end, they cut to the audience and there's somebody with the mask there, pulls it off, and it's Johnny Carson. He says, now I can be on every night. But it's something about the milieu, I guess, of having to kill off everyone in a genre or something. It's very odd.
Well, the other movie that it took this as an inspiration, and probably because ABC got decent ratings with it every time it ran, In, I think, 1980, they made a film. Aaron Spelling. Aaron Spelling produced this, called Murder Can Hurt You. And it's all the TV detectives, but it's almost entirely Aaron Spelling characters, right? So you've got a fake Starsky and Hutch and a fake...
That was terrible.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful. The whole thing is on YouTube.
Yeah, I scanned through that. Oh, you mentioned that. I scanned through it. It is horrible.
It is atrocious.
It makes this look fantastic, just by the way.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, you've got a lot of good people in this. But, you know, Tony Danza doing Beretta and Gavin McLeod doing Kojak.
Jamie
and Buck
Farr.
Owens doing McLeod.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, Victor Buono doing Ironside or Iron Bottom, because that's the level of writing you have in this. And but I remember seeing this when it aired, too, and going, hey, that was almost clever. And but I was nine, you know, and both of these. Well, both of these would be okay. They're written on the level of like a second-rate Carol Burnett show sketch, which I've been watching a lot of Carol Burnett recently, and you know some of them are funny just because of the actors. They're not well written. They're silly and they're designed to be broken up in the middle of, you know, and have Tim Conway make Harvey Korman collapse and you know that's fine in a 15-minute thing. And when you have a 90-minute or 2-hour movie, and it's like, yeah, that joke was funny 90 minutes ago, and you're still doing it, and please stop. And, you know, but again, it appealed to me when I was 7, when I watched Murder by Death. And, you know, it's like, I always had fond memories of it, and going back to watch it, and I went, oh no.
I want to bring up like the modern version of that too is like talking about Nick and Nora just in passing is that Thrilling Adventure Hours Beyond Belief is a fantastic Nick and Nora parody, as well as also being well done. Like they often, you know, the actual plot isn't that thick necessarily, but it's very fun. It's what Paget Brewster and Paul F. Tompkins doing the main voices, and that's super fun.
We're nemesis again, Glenn.
Oh no,
I'm
you don't like
that. No, I really don't. I appreciate that it sounds like they're having fun, but I could not grasp onto anything. I would rather go back and watch the actual thing, not somebody making fun of it in a way that to me just seems pointless.
Oh my goodness. Well, there we go. Nemesis.
And I adore Paul F. Tompkins to like the ends of the earth, so the fact that I don't like that says something.
That's funny. There are other sketches in Thrilling Adventure I don't like, but I do like.
I think some of that is the writing.
So.
I'm just saying.
No, don't say it. Don't
I'm
say
not.
It. Don't
I'm. Say it. I will be. I will be polite. I usually don't mention this out loud, but it's a show that's written for everybody to have a ball at, as opposed to like putting on a good show or telling a good story.
And that is a perfectly fine aim to have. And just like I feel like all of the aims that this movie had were, you know, that's fine. I don't fault them for the direction that they decided to go. I just don't think that the execution in this case is excellent. Whereas with Thrilling Adventure Hour, I think their execution is that's what they're going for. They're doing what they're trying to do well. Here, I think they are doing what they're trying to do and not succeeding. But I will say another positive thing about Murder by Death. I quite liked the sets. And I felt that that was another thing just at the very beginning of the movie, that the direction and the way everything was lit and laid out until the room started flipping around. That was just weird. But all of that looked good. This was, I mean, it kind of made me think of Clue at the very beginning, you know, coming into this big house and the storm. And then I guess I kind of had my expectations up a little bit because I was thinking of Clue, which I love. And it just, Clue is funny in a very, very different way. This is just ridiculous.
Well Clue has characters.
It does.
That's, you know, that's the first thing. And they may not be very deep, but they're characters. They're not just spoofs and caricatures. And I mean, I say it again. The best thing in this is the Charles Adams opening and the movie poster. The movie poster is great.
So I'm trying to think if there's anything else we were to talk about. We'll move on to Chief Detective. But I think I want to ask for people's... Susie, I'm sorry. Did you have something else you wanted to say?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, sorry. I thought I heard you trying to say something.
Have we exhausted the poop jokes?
I think
there's a lot of poop.
Apparently, that doesn't happen.
You, You bring Estelle Winwood into a movie. You bring Estelle Winwood into a movie, and you make her make pee-pee jokes. Like, come on.
Yeah, that was painful. Just painful.
I will say, I had, as a test, I had, not really a test, but I had my 9-year-old watch this film with me. We didn't watch Cheap Detective together, but we did watch Murder by Death, and he thought it was hilarious. So it stands up the toll, you know. Right, he didn't know.
There you go.
But he had just read, actually, a bunch of Sherlock Holmes. He hadn't read any of the other detectives, but he's familiar with the genre. He's read a lot of, as we talked about on the Kids Mystery episode, we did a lot of that. So let's do just the final, I think we have a pretty uniform opinion about this, but because we're doing it in the spoiler part, thumbs up or thumbs down. Like, would you tell people this would be worth watching just for, like, historical amusement value? You'd say, you listen to this episode and that's enough. What's, David, what do you think?
But you know I'm a glutton for bad movies.
I know.
So, I mean, if you are a diehard mystery buff and you haven't seen this, I suppose it's worth watching. It's fitfully amusing. At the very least, you'll really like the sets and you'll really like the credits. And for, you know, just imagine Peter Sellers is making an ironic comment. He's not, but it works better if he is. Yeah, I would watch it. I would say it's awful. Don't expect much. But
that's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, that's the pull quote.
But fair enough. Susie, what do you think?
Truman Capote on screen. So
he is pretty cool, isn't he? I think he's
awesome. He almost steals the movie.
Whenever he's on screen, it's wonderful. Erica?
I would not recommend anybody watch this. Steven watched it with me, mostly because I think he read the cast list ahead of time. Yeah. And at the end, there's this slow turn of the head and this very specific look he gives me after I have made him watch something that he hates so much. And it was just like his shoulders were almost vibrating because he was so just disgusted with the last hour and 24 minutes of his life.
He watched it because he loves you.
Yeah, I apologized to him. I was like, that was not good. I'm sorry. So he was going to watch The Cheap Detective with me and just was like, nope, I'm out. I cannot do that.
Oh,
so
no.
Sadly.
And John, what's your final call on this? You think people should watch or no, based on?
Well, if you grew up during the 70s, watching a movie like this will take you right back to the 70s, but it will also remind you of why we left the 70s behind. So I would suggest anyone interested just go onto YouTube and find one of those best of compilation clips.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this is probably in your library's collection. I rented both of them, and later Susie's like, oh, I'm getting it out from the library. And I'm like, the library. I didn't have to pay for this piece of... I just found one thing I wanted to drop in because since we've been bashing the film about our reaction today to it and so forth, but I found a couple facts about it that are amazing. It was the number 8 moneymaker in 1976. David Niven's son.
Well, with that cast.
Yeah, I know. The people came out.
$32 million.
Word of mouth was not a thing then, but it's like people come out for opening weekends, and films open much more slowly. I think Jaws was before that, so Jaws pioneered the national open, but still, you could sometimes see. But the other thing is, so David Niven's son worked for a company that invested in it, expecting it to be a loss, and it made a bunch of money. Peter Sellers apparently said he wasn't pleased with his performance or the film. He called it the epitome of 8mm home movie making to the producer, and he sold his percentage for $1.3 million. So who knows how he did. Alec Guinness considered the movie a very funny film. And he went to Hollywood to make it. He liked it. Script made me laugh. And not many things in recent times have done that. So nothing changed. I thought that was fascinating, though. All right. So let's we're going to unfire the spoiler horn. So those folks who are avoiding spoilers are back. And we're going to talk about The Cheap Detective, the 1978 sort of sequel, but not exactly, to Murder by Death in just a moment. But first, before we get there, I want to talk to you briefly about the Incomparable membership program. So if you go to theincomparable.com/members, you can find out a lot more about what we're doing, what you get out of being a member. It's partly to support us. So you can go there and you can sign up at one of several levels. You can indicate when you sign up which show or shows you want to offer your support for. If you choose none, it gets split up among all the programs, and a little bit taken off the top for to run the network. But you can also check Afoot or Afoot Plus other shows, and it's divvied up primarily among us. And that helps us pay for editing and other expenses associated with producing episodes like this. And if you're a member, you get extras, including so far 13 bonus episodes available only to members that are coming out in the month of March. 13.
Soon to be 14.
Oh my gosh. 14.
Soon,
oh, that's right.
Soon to be 15.
15. Holy cow.
As well as a preview of the second season of Radio Theater.
Oh my gosh.
Whoa.
Folks, so it just keeps getting better. And this just shows that if you're not a member, you don't have access to. But if you are, the bonus stuff is in a special feed that only members can reach. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 a month. You can also pay in advance for an entire year if you like. If you're a member, you can increase your pledge to a higher level. And there's one more thing you'll get. You'll get this thing we call the bootleg feed, which is the raw recording after we record, sometimes weeks or months before an episode actually airs, from the main Incomparable show and occasionally from other shows. We're going to release an Afoot bootleg from our we recorded a special crossover episode of Afoot and Game Show playing the game Murder, She Rolled. I'm sorry, Murder, She Wrote, called Murder, She Rolled. And David Lore was in a test episode of this game. Eric
Oh, dear God.
I know.
Flashbacks.
It's coming up. That'll be in the bootleg. We did a test I think that came off. Actually, it was very fun. And then we did a full episode after having tested the game as audio with Eric Ensign and some other panelists who are Murder, She Wrote aficionados. So you get that as part of your bonus. But so the bootleg, some people really like it. We just posted a game show bootleg of Low Definition that was about 2.5 hours long. And people were listening to it and chiming in the membership Slack group. If you're a member, you get access to a Slack group, a Slack team that you can be part of.
That may be the best reward of all.
It really is.
We're so fun.
We're hanging out.
And we all come and play in there. And
hundreds of members are already part of it. And it's just another place. We know how nasty and upsetting the internet can be at times. This is a place where you can be with other people who actually like the same sorts of stuff you do. And we'll talk about it without yelling at you. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. So, again, theincomparable.com/members. Go there, find out more information, and if you become a member, you'll have links to all of these special episodes. Thank you very much for supporting what we do, because we love our listeners. We really do. And You know, we like talking about this stuff, and it is just overjoying to us that anyone would care to listen and give us feedback and tell us what they like, too. So, thank you all panelists for being part of this episode and part of this network, and now we'll go on to The Cheap Detective. We just did. So Peter Falk, we all love Peter Falk. Apparently, sounds like.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we just did
Peter Falk. Peter Falk is pretty cool in my book.
And the Columbo episode of Afoot just aired chronologically just before this one, so you'll find that in our feed if you want to see Peter Falk in a slightly less comedic role. But so he did this great. I mean, talk about. So this is our spoiler-free version here. We're going to talk about The Cheap Detective, which was, like I said, quasi sequel to Murder by Death, and again also a parody, but the character, you know, of all the characterizations in Murder by Death, Peter Falk was probably the most dead on, because I forgot who was saying it's sort of doing Peter Falk, it's kind of his thing. Mm-hmm. And he was great. So let's do our overview of The Cheap Detective before we fire off the spoiler horn again, and we'll get into spoilery things. Anybody want to do a little quick summary of this movie? I can take it.
Go for it.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I had to check the year release of Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid because I got confused. Mm-hmm. Right. So Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid was 1982 with Carl Reiner. So that's interesting.
Saw that in the theater.
Oh, I think I did too, now that you mentioned it. And that has that, just sidebar, that has a joke that my wife and I still cite to each other. It's David, you know the exact line. It's going to make a batch of my famous Java. There's a line.
I know the joke. And
Steve Martin starts pouring coffee into a pan. He just pours it and pours it. It's an endless bag. And he just pours it, and it starts to peter out. And just when it starts to peter out, he pours and more comes out. This goes on for minutes in the movie, I swear. Mm. My wife and I, that's one of the jokes we like. But it's not. So this movie came out 4 years before that. And I think Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, obviously enforced by it. Cheap Detective is full-on Philip Marlowe, Sam Spade-ish genre thing, and it parodies two films that intersect The Maltese Falcon, which we've talked about in a previous episode of Afoot, with our friend Dylan McConus, whose family has a shrine to Humphrey Bogart, so she knows that film very well. And the other movie is Not The Big Sleep, but
Casablanca.
Which,
well, it's got a lot of stuff too. I mean, it's got a little Chinatown and a little Big Sleep and a little Have and Have Not. I mean, it hits all the bogey.
The sets of characters are from those two movies, and then there's all kinds of stuff around the edges. And I was looking, you know, the thing is, Erica, you're talking about mise-en-scène for the Murder by Death. This thing is beautifully set decorated. They recreated the Casablanca. I mean, Rick, right?
It's gorgeous, and the way that it is shot and staged and filmed is gorgeous. This, I'm not being spoilery. I'm just saying that it is the spoofing factor of this is turned up to 10 and yet turned down to 1 at the same time, because if you didn't know that you were coming into a spoof film and you just turned it on right in the middle and you saw somebody with the lighting specifically like right around their eyes and the cheesecloth in front of them, you know, you might not know for a second until you, you know, were listening to what they were saying. You might not know that you were watching something that was supposed to be parodying that type of film because it was so gloriously done. That was really a fun thing to watch.
In fact, the very first time I saw this, I came in about 20 minutes late, not knowing what it was. I was just flipping channels and sometime in the 80s. And I thought it was, you know, it's like, what is this movie? And then it started getting funny. And then Peter Falk showed up and I went, I know what it is.
And what was it?
Sorry. It was Chinatown.
It was Chinatown.
Forget it, Glenn. It was Chinatown.
There we go. So I don't know. We can get spoilery pretty fast with this, I think, but I'm not sure there's any other setting we need to do for it. Maybe we should fire up the spoiler horn. Is it time? So let's get into it. I want to bring up one thing right away, which I found really funny, is like the movie, just the cast, again, an amazing cast and much more comedy focused cast, although some great names in there. A movie that has James Coco and Dom DeLuise is a very interesting movie. I find it hard to tell them apart, even though I know they're different actors. Then Madeleine Kahn and Eileen Brennan, it's not that I mistake the two. It's just there's a certain kind of totally committed over-the-topness to what they do that makes me think of them as allied people. So like at times I was like, wait a minute, that's okay. Yeah, no, I know that's Eileen Brett. And then you have Marsha Mason in it and Margaret. I mean, it's sort of it's an incredible, it's like a surfeit of wonderful actors in it.
And John Houseman being silly.
Oh my God. That was so weird. In a fat suit or a big suit or something. He looked like David Byrne or something.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the actors in this film had a much better grasp of how they were supposed to be playing the characters. They all seem to, I mean, sometimes it was a little too silly even for my taste. Actually, that's not hard. It's very easy to be too silly for my taste. But that seemed to fit the scenes in which they were being that silly. Like each scene had its own sort of tone and that worked.
Well, and you have a consistent tone for the whole thing. You're not trying to shove like an Agatha Christie and a Dashiell Hammett and, you know, all of these weird blends into this one thing, and so it's easier for them to all, and it's easier to then point at the films they're spoofing to say, you know, oh, I need to do research for this part, I can watch this is what I'm doing. Okay.
Yeah, when I was watching Murder by Death, it kept reminding me of Clue, only in a bad way. Like, I wish I was watching Clue. When I was watching this, it kind of reminded me of the OSS 117 movies.
Oh,
if you have seen those.
Yeah.
Which those movies, like I saw one of the earlier ones at a film festival in Madison, and it made me laugh out loud along with most of the rest of the audience. Still a little too silly for my taste, but I felt like this was kind of on a par with that as far as how successful they were with recognizing the genre that they were playing around with and taking those tropes and doing some of them pretty much straight on, but surrounded by things that were ridiculous and funny, which made that funny. And then sometimes just going over the top with stuff. And both of them worked to different extents, but I enjoyed most of it.
Well, and one of the things that stood out to me this time is, you know, I watched Airplane and Top Secret last week, too. And there's a very similar difference between the two movies is between these two movies, in that here you have something that has a template, right? There's a very easy, you know, you're doing a hard-boiled plot, you're doing Bogart, whatever. But the template is there. You don't need to think about that. Whereas Murder by Death is totally its own thing, and it's trying to fit all these working parts and doing all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Airplane is almost scene for scene the movie Zero Hour,
mm-hmm.
and it's brilliant because they have a template to work from. And Top Secret is a totally original thing. It's like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if Elvis had done a World War II movie, but it was in the present day? And there is no clear template to it. And so the things that work in it are brilliant, and the things that don't just jar the whole time you're watching. It is a very inconsistent film.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same kind of thing. I enjoyed this so much more now than I ever did before because it doesn't have to work at what it's doing. It knows what it's trying to do, and it can just get to being funny.
It's I think it also has just this this wonderful, so it has great comedians, but also has these wonderful dramatic actors that are like John Houseman is being ridiculous, but I think that Louise Fletcher practically steals the movie. She's earnestly, deeply committed. I mean, it's sort of a stunning role. Like, I kept not. Like, I mean, the things she did that made me laugh out loud because she's so completely earnest in the context of it. And then Nicole Williamson, who's a maniac, is again absolutely, I think, perfect in playing this ridiculous part to the best. I mean, you know, so James Cromwell, another actor, play these sort of aides de camp, but they're sort of very farcical. I think they're actually a little bit distracting, but Nicole Williamson is just absolutely there.
Strange little side note. This is at about the time Nicole Williamson did a Columbo episode.
Oh my gosh.
He was also drinking very heavily and claims to have no memory of the Columbo episode.
Interesting.
So who knows if he even remembers this.
Interesting. Other folks have some thoughts. What was your reaction to seeing this and you know, its verisimilitude or the enjoyment factor compared to Murder by Death?
When I was watching it, I was thinking about the films that were going into the blender to make this.
Yeah.
And I know that you mentioned Philip Marlowe, but this seemed to me to be pretty much Sam Spade the whole way through. I mean, it's the exact setup of the Maltese Falcon, and the only thing that seemed Raymond Chandler-y was the fact that it had this long convoluted plot that kept running into dead ends that added up to nothing. But what was interesting to me was I was thinking with all the Casablanca stuff, I was thinking like, what the hell? Why Casablanca in the middle of this? And I realized, oh yeah, because of the Bogart connection. And I was thinking like, the thing that was interesting about this is how it made clear the way that all those great Bogart roles can kind of mix together in your head somehow, you know, and the way that, because Bogart basically played one guy.
Yep.
And so it's a kind of a, there's a kind of a meta commentary here that I don't know if it was intended, but it's quite remarkable.
That's why Sabrina is so disturbing because of that.
Yep. Just talking about that.
Yep.
Good. I'm glad I'm not the only one. Sorry, John. Please proceed.
We like the Harrison Ford Sabrina.
Maybe a little bit less creepy. Sorry. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I guess the other thing I felt was I was just so happy when Madeline Kahn showed up, and I realized how many films of my childhood Madeline Kahn was in. And I know now as an older guy and the guys look back on all those films, the connection between her and Mel Brooks and the whole group of people who all worked with Sid Caesar, that there was this kind of a troop of players there. But I just love seeing these people show up again, you know, I realized when I was watching this that she isn't given a lot to do on the page, but she's just so wonderful to watch. And then I start to think that's really true about almost every role she's ever played, that she was kind of given crap roles that she just did the most marvelous things with.
Oh yeah. The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother is an awful movie, and she is fantastic in it. Speaking of Bogart always playing the same thing, there's also, if you go looking for old radio shows, there's a show he did with Lauren Bacall called Bold Venture,
ooh,
which they did it as a syndicated thing for a year to have stability at home. They were expecting a child, and it was like, all right, I'm just going to act in this and make a lot of money.
Oh.
And it's clearly got some DNA from To Have and Have Not and a little bit of Casablanca. And it's sort of like Bogey's Greatest Hits reconstituted as a weekly half an hour radio show. And it's a lot of fun. It's very weird because Lauren Bacall is his ward, but then he has what? Romantic feelings with her. And well, because she was so much younger than him at the time. Well, at the time. and yeah, so it's weird. It's like sometimes he's protecting her because she's his ward, and sometimes he's protecting her because, you know, oh, it's the girl I want to sleep with. And it's a very strange tone to be playing, and it goes back and forth through the series. But aside from that, the series is a lot of fun.
So we've been talking for a bit about Cheap Detective, and one of our guests, Susie Steffen, has to leave us a little early. So I want to say thank you, Susie, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Totally fun. Thank you for introducing me to Cheap Detective and, I guess, to Murder by Death.
Well, I'm so sorry.
The one is better contrast, right? At least you got it from
good
the library.
Good to know.
All right. We'll talk to you again. We'll come back to Cheap Detective, but we're signing. We don't want you to think Susie's been sitting there quietly for another 20 minutes. So we'll talk to you later, Susie.
All right. Thanks a lot, you guys. Okay. Take care.
Bye. So I have to say, one of the things that made me laugh so much about this, I mean, there were a lot of things. There were moments I realized watching Cheap Detective, I was laughing out loud, which I'm not sure I did in Murder by Death at all. But I know it's ridiculous. But the one thing that got me is every time they said, when they did the anagram from Vladimir to Jerem Emowitz to Ezra C.B. Mildew Desire Jr., there's just something so like Dr. Seuss and like Monty Python. It was sort of Monty Python-y. I was like, Ezra C.B. Mildew Desire Jr. with a Z in Desire. That got me. I just...
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of fun, just dopey jokes in this. And the dopey jokes are funny, whereas they're just not in Murder by Death.
When
Scott charming. McCruthers... That was... Yeah. I think that was the biggest thing that Murder by Death was missing. There was no charm in it. It was... I mean, you mentioned the actors sometimes trying to upstage each other. I think John was the one that said that. But I felt like the characters were also trying to upstage each other in a way that was more backbitey than sweet and charming. So I felt much warmer to this film. I mean, this is the one, like I said, it was my boss who mentioned it to me for the first time ever, and she just loves it. It's one of her favorite movies, and it's one of those ones that she will just put on an afternoon when she wants to lie on the couch under a blanket, and it's just comfort food. And I can totally see how this movie works for that. And she even said, she's like, yeah, there's another one called Murder by Death, but it's not as good. And I feel like she was being very generous to that film when she said that.
And I mean, you know, you're writing for Peter Falk, so right there, you know, you have to go a long way to make Peter Falk unlikable. And you're not having to handle anyone else's egos. You're not having to balance any other characters that are supposed to be equal to him. He's the star of this one. And so he sets that tone. So even if the script is lousy, and I don't think it's great, it's good, it's fun. But I give it a pass because I just enjoy Peter Falk.
I also think they capture this wonderful thing. I was thinking, John, about your Bogey reference about being the same. And Peter Falk, I think, has the same thing. He's kind of a funny looking little guy, and he's great in his way. It's not that he's unattractive, but you know, he's got a look, and it's kind of raggedy. And the fact that like the film is sort of making a joke about Bogart and women, obviously, right? I was thinking of particularly The Big Sleep. This is why I was thinking about the bit in The Big Sleep where Bogart is trying to stake somebody out. So he walks into a bookstore that's run by a woman. She immediately basically says, "Yeah, I'll sleep with you." Out of no, like, it makes no sense. And she closes the bookstore, you know, pulls the shade, and apparently they go to the back room and shag or something. And it's utterly like ridiculous how it's set up, but that's kind of the Bogey thing. It's like women just swoon, and I think this is true in real life as well, but women just swooned for him.
I don't get it. I just don't get it.
So, but whatever his magnetism was, I think they make good fun of it and sort of a little bad fun in some way. Like at some point it kind of became annoying, but I'm like, oh my God, how many women? It's like, then the scene, I started laughing when there's like, the widow in the kitchen or in the bathroom, right? I mean, that with the women in each room, and then Stalker Channing comes to the door, and then Eileen, like, I didn't see where they were going with the Eileen Brennan, or not Eileen Brennan, rather, but the Madeline Kahn's character. I did like how she kept manufacturing names when he first meets her. That was funny, because, I mean, certainly in the Maltese Falcon, she is at least three names, maybe more. But then when she shows, starts showing up in costumes, and she comes to the door in the like bird watching outfit and the bicycle, I was just laughed literally out loud. Mm-hmm. LOL.
Yeah, and I loved Stockard Channing in this. She, I mean, I kind of love her in everything.
Yeah.
She's like that. She's wide eyed and perky, and she clearly likes him. And then there's the part where she, you know, she's never been thanked before, which is just delightful. And yet she knows about all of these other women. Because she's his gal Friday and is, you know, right there for him. And, you know, she's like the third time he opens the door and sends a woman out. She's like, oh, is there another one? I can wait. Like, she's completely fine with it. Totally patient. She doesn't mind. I appreciate that in a character. That at least we have one woman in this film early on who recognizes him for the womanizer he is and accepts him for it. So it's not entirely, it makes it feel kind of less sleazy and less objectionable because we have a female character's viewpoint who's okay with it. So I was glad of that as a viewer.
I dug the fact that he starts like saying, okay, I'll meet you at the Oakland Ferry. What? I'll see you at the, you come to the, like, they're just all the, which is very Bogart too. Like, everybody's like, we'll go. You don't know what, like, we're going to meet at the docks at 4:00. We'll be at the, you know, the train station at, and then there are all these different places, and they pulled it all off, right? Everyone winds up in the right place at the end.
Right.
Yep.
And I mean, now the thing that always confused me was that he's essentially playing the same character, and Eileen Brennan is basically playing the same character, but they're not the same character.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's why it's a not sequel.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a spiritual
sequel. And you know, that's fair, right? How many different detectives did Dashiell Hammett write about who could be interchangeable names? You know, mm-hmm. It works. It's okay.
David Ogden Stiers.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the one bit of Murder by Death that worked the best, I thought. So why not take that successful chunk and transplant it into soil where it can actually flourish and grow?
They made a lot of money. So David Ogden Stiers is in this also in a very small part, and I didn't realize I was looking at the facts. He was making MASH at the same time. So they were filming this around MASH, and he apparently arranged some of the music for The Cheap Detective.
Well,
I know. It's got good music, I think, too. Murder by Death is totally, mm-hmm. I can't remember, but I thought Cheap Detective had quite a good soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. I remember commenting at one point, like, it was after Stephen had gone to do a podcast because he didn't want to watch it with me. And then he came back partway through and he sat down and I'm like, this one's much better. And so I had somebody to talk to. And at one point I was just like, the music in this is so perfect. Just the way that it would swell at just the right time, exactly the way that, you know, that the movie it was spoofing would have done, except just a hint more, with more verve, you know, to pump it up a little bit. That was excellent.
I also liked Fernando Lamas's performance, which is, you know, again, a small part of the film, but he did such a perfect channeling of, oh, I don't remember the actor's name, who's in Casablanca.
Damn it. See, now he just fled from mine. Victor Laszlo.
That's your thing.
Paul Henreid.
Well, thank you. I just figure you know everything about every movie, David. It's just my thing. But the bit at the end where he's like, yeah, you know, he's like, but yes, we'll always have this time together. You'll always be important to me. But are you sure there are carbons in with the papers? And it's just, I don't think of him as that, you know, that kind of actor. He's very good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another part that I quite liked was when they were in the bar and Paris had been taken over and the Germans start singing, which that's totally, I can see that happening in plenty of classic films. And then, but then you get the French people singing their national anthem and it's just like, you know, it's basically the vocal equivalent of a dance-off. And then, which I thought in and of itself was kind of funny. And then they one-up that by starting to sing whatever it was, Jeepers Creepers, I can't remember.
Well, they sing some song I remember, and then Scatman Crothers leaps in with Jeepers Creepers, his
that's right.
Mm-hmm. Flagship.
Yes.
John, do you have memories or thoughts about this?
You know, the one thing I was going to say, looking back on the two films, this film, I think, hits a better tonal balance, about, especially when it comes to issues of verisimilitude. This film has a few things that are just ridiculous and absurd, such as at the very beginning of the film when they find the people who've been shot and they're all just kind of standing there frozen. Yes. Because we're told that whomever shot them so quick they didn't even have a time to react. And that's silly and goofy. And yet it didn't take me out of the movie the way that, for example, in Murder by Death, halfway through the film, we're told that the cook isn't a real cook. She's a mannequin,
yeah,
and she's presented in a box. And at that point, you kind of feel like, if it's going to be this kind of level of surreal, I don't really care about the solution to the mystery, because at this point, everything is just like the laws of the universe are just up for grabs. There's no, and that's okay. You can do that sort of thing. You can do that kind of Monty Python-esque, everything's going to just, you know, freewheeling anarchy. But they kept trying to treat Murder by Death as though we cared about the solution, which you don't. This film actually has a solution, which you kind of care about, because it does. This film, I think, better than the other one, also understood, you know, what made those hard-boiled movies tick, which was they would always have this kind of an instigating mystery, but then there'd be these ancillary things that would come up that, you know, may or may not be related to the main mystery, and that was what you kind of like screwed around with and found out about, and then it ends up in the end that the solution to the mystery of who shot Falk's partner is actually pretty obvious and pretty much what you would have thought all along, but you've gone on this long journey which has involved, you know, this Casablanca subplot has involved the recovery of these stolen diamonds and stuff. You know, it feels much more like it knows what it's doing.
Hey, wait a minute. We never do find out what happened with the diamonds, do we? I guess we never find out in Maltese Falcon what happened with the bird either.
I mean, people used to ask Raymond Chandler about the big sleep, and he admitted he didn't quite know how it all fit together, and he was pretty sure that there's at least one body unaccounted for in the solution.
Oh my God.
At least one.
That's, well, with the big sleep, that story is that Faulkner asked him what was going on, and he said he didn't know. Part of the problem with the big sleep is that in the novel, there's a whole section that has to do with a jealous homosexual lover killing his boyfriend, and they wanted to take that completely out of the Hollywood movie. But when you take that out, it removes a whole link in the chain of the mystery.
Right.
And so that's just kind of elided over in the movie. And so, yes, the movie makes no sense, actually, as it stands.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, as you were speaking, I think something occurred to me. And that is that one of, for me, the main reasons that I think The Cheap Detective works so well and Murder by Death doesn't is that Murder by Death is spoofing existing characters, whereas Cheap Detective is spoofing a film genre. And it's so much easier to spoof a genre or a style of things rather than taking a bunch of fake characters and then making them faker and just shoving them all together and stringing them together. You know, it's kind of like, what are these, you know, what are the connective threads in Murder by Death? It doesn't matter. We've got all these characters. That's all that matters. Whereas it's the connecting thread itself that is the excitement and what is worked on so hard, and the characters that fit in amongst that thread, you know, the beads on that necklace are placed there because they make sense there.
And I will pay a compliment to our own in-house playwright, David Lohr, David J. Lohr, in that when you do a parody and you do a parody well, then if it's not outright farce, but you're trying to paint characters, the parody should develop a life of its own, so that you actually not only do you pay homage to and get the joke and enjoy the hilariousness of that, but you come at the end of the work to something in which you have a deeper understanding of this parallel character that now has a different life. And I think, David, I think you do that in the radio theater, depending on the kind of the degree of farce that's being employed. And I think Cheap Detective, at the end, you feel like Lou Peckinpah is Fred or whatever his name is. No, Lou Peckinpah is kind of his own man, separate from the source material. And it's not profoundly so, but you accept a kind of like a, not authenticity, I guess, an integrity to a character that's developed through it and has kind of seen this way through and reaches the end of this bizarre journey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when I'm sitting there doing radio, I am not just thinking, hey, what would be funny, what would be a good joke, or, you know, what incomparable in-jokes can I throw in, or, you know, whatever. I'm actually thinking, you know, what's going to be a good story? And it I mean, it still amazes me when I can make myself cry doing things with these characters in the context of this really goofy show, right? Timmy Preston Galaxy Scout made me cry. That's wrong. That's, you know. So, I mean, that's why I appreciate this. Because, again, it's like I was saying before, it's the template. You have something to go from, which is all I'm doing in radio theater. It's very, you know, I can write them without thinking because I already know how a Private Eye Noir is going to work or a space adventure is going to work or whatever it is.
Well, I think this is again a clear answer. It's like I'll go first. I guess is I thought this was enjoyable to watch. I think the one thing, there were a few points in the film I will say where it was too much of a exact copy with minor changes from one of the source movies, and I was like, well, this is just them. It's a little too much exposition. They could have been more original, like John Houseman explaining the history of the Albanian eggs or whatever. It was like, well, let's change a few things and have the, and it was sort of the core thing, and I thought he did a good job with it, but it was a little bit too much exposition. But that's my primary criticism, is there are moments like that where they're just copying stuff over to kind of push it along, and that's a small part of it. I enjoyed watching it, laughed out loud genuinely a number of times, and found it generally satisfying. Other verdicts, John?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that there were segments that I got a little frustrated with how close they followed the original source material. Because and you knew there was a joke coming, and you were like, hurry up, get to the joke, come on, please. but the other thing I would say about that is both of these films are, after all, 70s films.
Yes.
And they are paced very differently than modern films. So with that in mind, I will give this a big thumbs up. But you know, expect to sit on your hands for a bit during this watching this.
Yeah, there's a shagginess to 70s films that I enjoy.
Yeah, that's right.
Where I mean, it's one of the reasons I love Wonder Boys. Wonder Boys is a relatively modern film that feels like a 70s film intentionally. I mean, that was an influence on it. Where you get to hang out with characters and you get these digressions and it's okay. It's usually not too out of the way, right? You're still following the plot. You're not wasting time, but there's room to breathe. And yeah, I exactly, adjust your expectations, be prepared to be patient, but it's fun.
And Erica, did Steven regret not watching this one with you or watching all of it?
Honestly, I think even if he had watched all of it, I still don't think it would have been for him. I think it was too silly. And he doesn't know the source material, so he would not have gotten any of the in-jokes at all. So it would have been just a weird, strange, mystery-type movie that he just probably would have had trouble following and not cared about. So, I'm glad that he didn't end up watching both of them. I am glad that I watched them in chronological order, because it would have really sucked to do it the other way around and end with Murder by Death. I quite enjoyed watching The Cheap Detective. I don't think for me it's going to become a comfort food movie, probably simply because it is a 70s movie and it does have sort of that shaggy feeling. I mean, as I've said before on many incomparable podcasts, my happy place in movie land is from like the mid-30s to like maybe the beginning of the 50s. Like, you know, once things start going to color, they start going to pot. Figuratively and literally.
Well, we have to do some Nick and Nora episodes, or an episode at least. I think that's that is clearly the case.
Definitely.
Well, we're on the spoiler horn side of things, but those of you who've stuck with us to who've seen the movies and have listened this far, thank you for tuning in. And let me thank our panelists, our own Ezra CV Mildew Desire Jr. David Lohr. I think that's a compliment.
I think it's a compliment. I'm not entirely sure. I'm just going to get in my car, and I got my dog here. I got to go take him to the vet. It's fine. It's just, you know, it's a whole other thing.
Would you buy a Golden Gate Bridge from this man? And Erica Ensign, thank you for working through the one film to enjoy the second.
Thank you so much. But sorry, no tip.
No tip. That's right. War veteran.
War veteran.
And John McCoy, on your deathbed, appreciate you coming in and checking out. You'll get better, I promise.
I'm looking forward to the big sleep after we end
That's good. And folks, thank you for joining us in this episode of Afoot. We'll be back again soon.